Get ready. The DE Talk podcast starts now. Insightful conversations and dialogue helping you put the human factor back in HR.
Whether you walk into a mom and pop shop in small town USA or an office in the city, they all have one thing in common. We're hiring signs plastered on the front door or several openings on the career site. The wave of talent shortages following the pandemic has affected most employers, so much so that industries are struggling to maintain their levels of service they once held. How are they coping? Many are limiting hours, while others are getting creative with hiring, turning to often overlooked talent pools, or as our guest Mike Thibodeau of Indiana-based Invest Hamilton County refers to it, the anonymous workforce, workers who are early in the post-substance abuse recovery journey. Mike, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
As a former recruiter, this conversation really struck a chord with me because so many recruiters get stuck recruiting in the same places over and over again. And I think this conversation may really open some eyes. Before we jump in, can you share a little bit with our listeners about yourself and some of your background education?
Yeah, sure. So I grew up in Metro Detroit, come from a fairly...
Wait. You grew up in Detroit?
Yeah.
I'm from Ohio. That's tough.
I guess.
Can we have this conversation? I'm just kidding.
Probably.
Okay.
I went to Michigan State, so I don't really care too much. We probably dislike the same people, so we're probably okay.
We're good. All right, we're good.
But, you know, growing up in traditional middle-class household in Metro Detroit, pretty, you know, standard middle-of-the-road upbringing. And I ended up going to Michigan State. I got my BA in public policy and public administration. Following that, I went to work on political campaigns for a number of years. And then I eventually relocated here to Indiana.
What brought you here?
I came here to work for my fraternity, their international headquarters. It's actually a really big industry in the nonprofit space here in central Indiana. I would say the vast majority of fraternities and sororities are actually headquartered here in Indianapolis.
Yeah, I think our old office, actually.
If you're over by the pyramids, there's a whole bunch of them right there. Yeah. So came here to do that work. Then after that, we started running a construction association before working at the Chamber, which is kind of the overall project that we're talking about today with that Indiana Workforce Recovery Initiative. And then today I'm the president and CEO of Invest Hamilton County, which is Hamilton County's Economic Development Corporation. But kind of throughout all of that, you know, I came from a household with two loving parents, and you know, and all the privilege and blessings you could look for in this world. But I did still have a lot of trauma that occurred within my childhood and within my life. That did lead to a lot of chronic anxiety, insecurity, a number of mental health issues, which eventually, you know, led me down a path where within that story of gainful employment and that career trajectory that I just laid out, there was almost a year of homelessness. There was involvement with the justice system. There was a multi-year, over a decade struggle myself with addiction that came in through that. And it's really interesting because, you know, if you read my bio and people like see, you know, they interact with me, I like to joke that it looks like all I used to do was go to kindergarten. And then like, I just like became an adult. You know, being a white man, you know, living in Carmel, there's a lot of assumptions made, I think, about what my life has been and what my life is. But the reality is that it's had a lot of struggle attached to it as well. And so I think that's really where, in all my jobs, I've been able to find a nice little niche and opportunity of being able to put myself in other people's shoes that maybe otherwise are being overlooked within the labor market. And especially being a person who traditionally, you know, ever since I started at the construction industry, I remember I was there and they go, hey, guess what? You know, you're working for a construction association, workforce is now your thing. Like this is what you care about. And I said like, okay, I guess I got to learn about workforce. And the more I dove into it, the more that connection with those non-traditional hires kind of came to the forefront. And I would say that's something I've been able to do throughout my career is connect that non-traditional worker to traditional opportunity and success.
So really your position in the construction industry, that really led you into the workforce recovery space then, essentially.
So I was at that job and I was leading and developing some training programs in construction. I was doing a lot of hiring fairs with neighborhood centers throughout Indianapolis. I was working with churches, and we were doing work with corrections. And I started to be a little bit more vocal about telling my personal story. At first, I was pretty hesitant and closed off about it. But depending on how you view it, either the right people or the wrong people found out. And they said, oh, you're a person who's done workforce development work. You've worked with employers and businesses. And then you also have a personal connection to this issue. And I got approached by the some people, you know, that were working with the Chamber of Commerce and the governor's office saying, hey, like, you should apply for this job. Like, you should be the one leading this new thing that the governor and the chamber are trying to launch. And I looked at it. I said no to those people a couple times, and then eventually I said yes, and that was what really led me into that space.
Yeah, you can only tell the governor's office no so many times.
You know, I think that's how it goes, and I think also you can only – I knew that I didn't want my whole professional life to be addiction and recovery along with my personal life being a lot of that in what I do as a volunteer and in how I manage my chronic disease that I have. But – the opportunity for even just a couple years to be of even more direct service to my own community and the population at large in the state of Indiana was something that I kind of said, okay, like, I'll do this for 2 to 3 years. Mm-hmm. And I did it for 2 years and 8 months. and so, you know, and then I went back to the more normal economic development, workforce development world. But, you know, as we'll talk about as we go through the conversation, that kind of never went away once you're in. You know, you never get out. So
tell us a little bit more about your role with Invest Hamilton County. I mean, I live in Noblesville, also in Hamilton County, and I mean, this is kind of a selfish question. I'd like to know a little bit more about what you do there and kind of what your day-to-day may look like.
Oh, my day-to-day is a wonderfully organized chaos, is one way I'd put it. But what we do at Invest Hamilton County, so technically we're Hamilton County's Economic Development Corporation. We're the local economic development organization for Hamilton County. However, we're a really unique community in that Carmel, Fishers, Westfield, Noblesville, the cities themselves have these amazing economic development departments that do such a good job of driving business to their communities while also doing the traditional economic development activities like urban planning, tax abatements, the stuff you think of that would be my job. Mm-hmm. I do none of that. We exclusively focus on workforce development, education, and then what I broadly would call quality of life priorities that drive what we call economic vitality within our region. And the way I love to put it, and that I heard it put even better the other day by Fred Payne at United Way, is we want every person in our community to have a path to live the best life they possibly can. That means career pathways for everybody, regardless of your ability and where you come from. That means broadband access for everybody. That means a mental health support ecosystem that really has the ability to support employees and retain talent at our businesses. And it also means we continue to support the overall growth of our community in a equitable and in a really forward-thinking manner. And so that's where we sink our teeth into a whole bunch of different stuff. We're managing the Pursuit Institute project, which is a new career and technical education district that's been opened up between our 6 school corporations. We support mental health initiatives and training programs in the jail. We're diving deep into our disability environment and running training programs there. We're assisting the county with managing things like opioid settlement dollars and forward-thinking gap analysis and strategies for building up our mental health support ecosystem. And then we do a lot of research, data projects, labor market forecasting, and general workforce development and business services for our local community. So we're in a lot of different places doing a lot of different things, but kind of the centralizing idea of it is that right now Hamilton County has about 350,000 residents, 183,000 jobs. Before you know it, there's going to be 500,000 people, 250,000 jobs. What happens between where we are now and where we are then to make that growth occur in the right manner and keep our community at the top and keep us great for everybody, not just, you know, the college graduates and the, you know, the people coming in who can afford, you know, that great life.
How did you land in your current role? Like, what was the transition, the process from your old position into this one?
Well, so when I was with the chamber, I, you know, I told them, hey, like 2 to 3 years is what you got. And so I started to come towards the end of that time period. And I was like, hey, you know what? I want to get back into local work. I want to get back into economic development. Workforce development is my primary. And I knew the person who was in my role before. And she was retired. And I gave her a call and said, hey, I live in Hamilton County. I'd love to get local. Because I saw in my work at the chamber, I worked with a bunch of local leaders. Mm-hmm. And I saw how deep they were able to get on such a variety of topics. And also the impact they were able to have. They'd build these programs, but then they also were the ones on the ground implementing them and changing lives. And I said, I think that's where I want to be next. I want to go local somewhere. And the ability to do it in my own backyard, in a place that I feel so passionate about. I mean, I grew up in Detroit, but I've lived in Carmel for, I don't know, 11 years now. It's the only place I've ever, you know, paid a property tax. So it's kind of like owned property, had children, you know, the whole thing. That's where my kids are going to go to school. I'm, you know, I got Carmel roots now, and I think I got Hamilton County roots, and I want to give back to the community and make it a great place to live for everybody. And so after reaching out, I kind of figured out that it was a great opportunity. It seemed like an organization that through the pandemic had realized a lot of gaps that existed and was primed to do something, a lot of things even bigger. And coming on, I was the only team member. You know, now we're up to five, and we're going to just continue to grow and do great things, but also in a way that builds up other organizations around us and establishes anchors, you know, in these different realms that we operate in.
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, being a Hamilton County resident, I appreciate the work that you're doing. 24 years now for me in Noblesville. So awesome.
You've seen a big difference there.
I have. I think I've actually, let's see. I've lived here as long as I lived in Ohio now. So I'm, I think next year I'll actually officially be, hope no one hears this, maybe a Hoosier maybe. I think.
Are you a Colts fan? Is that?
Huge Colts fan.
Okay, yeah. So you converted there.
Yeah, I converted there. Pacer fan, always have been though.
Okay.
But I'm still a Buckeye fan, and I'll always be a Buckeye at heart, but I guess I do have some Hoosier roots, I guess. So I guess we'll admit that now. So walk me a little bit through what a non-traditional candidate might look like. You know, at the beginning, you know, we talked about how, you know, recruiters continually look in the same places over and over again. You know, and they wonder why they get the same results and why they're struggling filling their positions. But let's just talk about, you know, maybe, like I said, the non-traditional candidate, what that may look like, and, you know, maybe some areas where they may be found.
Yeah. So there's a lot of different pools of non-traditional workers. I think the main buckets people often think of are kind of justice involved, mm-hmm. disability, and then really unemployed is probably the wrong word, but people who have just been out of the labor market for a long time, chronically unemployed,
yes,
or underemployed,
I think that's the term, yeah.
You know, would be how we think about it. And then also I would say, depending on what type of position you're recruiting for, in some cases, even just expanding a position to not just be for a college grad can be considered opening up to a non-traditional pathway. Because if everybody before, if every job posting you've ever had for that job says you have to have a four-year degree, and all of a sudden you know, have a eureka moment and you're like, why? You know, like maybe we can change that to the or 10 years equivalent industry right. experience or 5 years experience, you know, that can be a big thing. And helping to recognize those lateral skill sets is a big deal for employers, because you may not think about how someone's retail work could make them a great front desk agent at a hotel. You may not think about how somebody who has worked on a, you know, home building site, you know, could then transfer those skills over to another type of occupation. And I think more than that, stigma allows us to put up walls for certain groups of people that make us preemptively think about what they can't do instead of what they can. And I see that a lot with our disability work. You know, the individuals on one end with intellectual and developmental disabilities, you know, the medical system, from the moment they're born, their parents are just told what this person will never do. And all of a sudden, that's the narrative that's in their brain, is they've got that same thing. But we can flip that. We can make it about what they can do. And really by focusing on those strengths, we're able to find great opportunity. And it's the same way for our reentry and recovery populations as well. These are individuals who chronically have just been grinding for the most part through life. In most cases, they started using substances when they were young. And as a result, it hasn't been, you know, rainbows and puppy kisses. If you start using when you're 12 years old, like I did, or, you know, when you're 14, 15 years old at a very high rate, your chances of achieving a college degree are probably lower, but your chances of also retaining employment are lower, and your relationships in your life are probably more strained. And as a result, the insecurity that you walk around with every single day is that much greater. And when we build hiring programs for these individuals, and when we engage with employers on how to develop these pathways, the number one thing we tell them is that fear is your opponent. Any moment in this person's life where they can have, even if it's an irrational one, a sense of this isn't real, this won't work, this isn't for me, I'm not good enough, they're gone. And that's the main difference between successful, not just attraction of this kind of talent, but also retention. I remember, we worked on a training program once, and we had an individual whose aunt died, unfortunately. And he just didn't show up to work because he had to go take care of her kids and help out his family. Every job he'd ever had before would have told him, hey, you know what? You have to come in or you're fired. But instead, we got a call from the HR rep going like, hey, you know, Johnny didn't show up to work today. We're worried about him. We just want to know if he's okay. I called up the local pastor, which is how they got connected to him, you know, through a career fair with us. And he told us the whole story. He said, hey, you know, like they had a death in the family. Did this. And we said, hey, tell Johnny to call work and tell them when he's coming back. He would have never called if that connection hadn't been made and if that employer hadn't reached out. And so it's taking that example and applying it to 50 other things, but also proactively telling employers, when you're engaging with this type of worker, tell them about those kinds of things in advance. We'll support you if you have a death in the family and need to take some, even if it's unpaid time off, you can come back. Hey, if you get, you know, if your kid gets sick, what happens? Because for so long, people who get, for lack of better words, trapped within these, you know, let's say $9 to $12 an hour service sector jobs where they're grinding through multiple jobs at a time, they're treated like warm bodies. And when we provide them with training and pathways to get up into really living wage positions where all of a sudden maybe they're not just treated like a warm body, you can't just assume that they'll all of a sudden recognize what that difference is and know how to react and proactively receive those employee supports from their employer. So the employer has to really be more proactive in telling them about it and saying, you know, day one, like, hey, here's our culture. We care about you. Your health and well-being is first. And allow culture to be something that isn't earned, but rather is unearned. I don't know. There's a different word for that. But, you know, give people accommodations and privileges just like you would if they've been there for a month and killing it
right
on day one. And make that a privilege they lose rather than something they have to gain.
Yeah. I totally agree with that. I mean, right now, obviously, the country is dealing with an addiction epidemic, really, and it's not just a public health issue. It's really becoming a workforce issue. Can you share some facts that may be surprising to listeners with regard to how many people may be struggling with addiction? And it doesn't have to be exact numbers. It's kind of general. I mean, I know that there's different types of addictions, too. So
you hear a lot of numbers like 1 in 5. You also hear, you know, there was a study in 2017 that showed 38% of Americans are dealing with illicit drug use. There's a lot of different statistics out there that'll show that this is a very frequent part of everyday American struggles. I know for us, we recognize that within the 2-year period that I was at the chamber, we had a lot of employers stop terminating people just on first failed drug tests. You know, the second one, you're out. But the first one, you know, let's get you connected to some type of education or best practice programming and keep you employed. And that amounted to about 60,000 workers a year in the state of Indiana that fell into that category of a first-time drug failure. And so, we think about our labor market and our employer situation. 60,000 people per year, that's a lot of workers.
That's just here.
That's just in Indiana. Yeah. And so when we think about employers' ability to retain that talent instead of letting it go, it has an effect on multiple lanes. One is, if somebody's more able to stay connected to a meaningful life and to society, their chances of going further downhill in their health are less. But then also, their chances of getting better are higher. When people have gainful employment and a connection to employment, their recovery outcomes are better across the board. And so we really do believe that helping employers with that is a top public health priority. And I think, some people would tell you addiction doesn't discriminate. They're like, doctors struggle with addiction, lawyers struggle with addiction. It's all true. But by the numbers, the one thing it does discriminate against is that people start using young. People who develop addiction, for the most part, start using when they're at a really young age. And that alone does hamper the opportunities that they have available to them. Therefore, if you do look at the admissions that people have to treatment centers, it does skew towards people that don't have a higher proportion than the general population, don't have high school diplomas, don't have college degrees, don't have advanced degrees. Because if I start using drugs when I'm 12 years old, how likely am I to even get through high school? Less likely. Yeah, it's fair to say less likely.
Yeah.
And so that's one of those areas too, is we need to recognize that when we're looking for, when we think of social services and supports and even employment opportunities, when we're looking for untapped talent to fill some of our hardest to fill positions in our economy, that's a place where they are. We have to give them education and training as well.
I mean, do you think that most of the individuals who are struggling with addiction, do you think they're seeking recovery programs or no, or is that
so
it'd be hard to
it's a complicated response, I guess. So about half of the people who ever meet like the medical AMA criteria for substance use disorder, they stop or they mitigate on their own due to like one adverse circumstance. Mm-hmm. So like, I getting back to college years, and you know, I had a bunch of buddies who probably drank way too much. That definitely met the criteria for potential alcoholism. If you're, you know, if you're looking at how many days a week they drank and how much they drank each of those days, they're definitely checking some boxes. You know, at the time they would have met that criteria, and some of them continued drinking like that after college for a little bit. But for the most part, they got a job, they had a family. Maybe one night they went out and drank too much. They didn't like how they felt the next day, and they just said, I'm going to pull back a little
bit.
Yep. I'm pulling back. That's about half of the people who ever meet the criteria are able to just put the brakes on themselves. The other half can't. And they have to go through, and they need to, if they ever stop, go through some type of medical intervention. But a lot of them don't. So right now in America, it's estimated that about 22 to 28 million Americans live in recovery. As in, they were dealing with a substance use issue and now are in remission, for lack of better words, with their disease. And so that's almost 10% of the population. Yeah. It's a lot of people.
What type of advice would you give employers? I mean, I know that you talked about, maybe talking to them about how they can give privileges right out of the gate instead of making people earn them. But what other types of things would you suggest that employers do to maybe ready themselves or maybe improve what they're doing for people who may be suffering from substance abuse or in their companies already?
Yeah. So Indiana Workforce Recovery at the Chamber did produce a really great evidence-based second chance policy that aligns with some state statute, provides liability protections for employers, talks about how to engage with medical community, how to use employee assistance programs more effectively. That's a really good resource I would just send anybody to think about what a really good second chance policy works, how that works. And to be clear, it's a second chance policy, not a third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, tenth chance policy. But the other thing I'd echo again, culture isn't earned. If you're the type of workplace that says, once we keep people for 90 days, they stay here for years, my question is, why isn't that 60 days? I can get why it's not 2 weeks.
Right.
You know, there are individuals in our society who go in and out of jobs. You know, that's fair. That's the thing that happens. But why is your 90-day mark not 60 days? Why? And then why can't it become 45? And I think setting those kind of benchmarks for yourself as a method of achievement is a really valuable thing for employers when they look at their long-term retention rates. And I think also that's very different depending on the type of work you do. So for, I mean, just as an example, a small business like mine, if I was losing any employees in 90 days, that would be a really high proportion. And it'd be a really big problem. You know, but I've supervised operations with hundreds of employees before. And yeah, in those processes, it had to be expected that a certain number of them were going to turn over, kind of realize the job wasn't the right fit and move on. The other part that I would say is look at your job descriptions and make sure they really map up against what you need. So a job description shouldn't be built to attract the ideal candidate. It should be considered the floor on which an ideal candidate can stand. And so if you think about it that way, if a person's looking at your job, they shouldn't be saying, I can't do that. Because if they are, and then they come to you and they go, hey, I can't do this. And you go, oh, no problem. We'll give you training. Then why is it on the job description, or why doesn't it disclose that they'll get training on how to do that specific skill? Because on the whole, especially when you look at workers who are making less than $20 an hour for many of these positions that exist in our society, again, fear and insecurity are such a huge part of this. They've been treated like a number so many places they've ever worked that if they can't see themselves being successful on day one, the chances that they make it to that magical 60 or 90 day mark is really limited. We also have to look at cultural expectations and thinking about what do you assume people have to know or should know on day one that you're not telling them. So when I was in construction, like a really easy example of that made a huge difference was in one of our training programs, we learned we had to teach people how to pack their lunch for a day at the job site. There's no fridge on a construction job site. You had to learn what is it like to pack that lunch on that first day? Because otherwise, maybe you don't eat. Or maybe you're invited out to lunch with people and you don't have money to eat. All of a sudden, you're feeling like an other from day one. How do we make you feel more like you belong and go into a workplace with as much confidence as possible? And that's a little bit less on the employer, but it still could be on the employer. But it's definitely more on what we see when we develop trainings is that sense of, what are those things that people are going to assume you need to know about that are going to make you feel like an other if you're not getting it day one? Because we all want to belong.
Right.
We all want to go into a place feeling like we're part of the team and we're part of the group that we're going into. We're tribal beings. So how can we give people more of that sense immediately? And I think that's the same aspect that the culture not being something that's earned thing. Like, this isn't some like people shouldn't be hazed for life. I mean, it's not hazing. But people shouldn't feel like they're getting hazed when they go into a new job. It shouldn't be like, okay, new guy, shut your mouth. It should be, okay, new guy, what value do you bring and how can you feel like you're part of the team day one? Every job has a learning curve, but that shouldn't apply to how you're treated.
It's always that first week when that anxiety is
oh my gosh.
Present. Yeah.
Yeah, bump it every time. Yeah. Regardless of where you're at in your career, you always have a little bit of that.
I mean, I've been here for 17 years and I still remember my first week of anxiety here, so... that was a long time ago. So, you know, with so many employers hiring, can you share how employers can engage and hire job seekers in early recovery? I mean, I know we kind of touched on that a little bit, but.
Well, so I think specific to early recovery, what I would say is you already probably are hiring them. You just don't know. Because if somebody's in early recovery, they can pass a drug test. They don't need any accommodations. They're an able-bodied, relatively sane member of society. If they come to you and apply for a position, they're good to go. They're not gonna come to you and they shouldn't be coming to you and saying like, hey, by the way, you know, like I 3 weeks ago I was doing a lot of drugs. You know, like that's not like a sane thing I would recommend anybody ever say in an interview process or anything like that. So I think more is just thinking about the fact that you do have employees who are applying for these positions that probably are in these things. So what 101 level foundational supports are you putting into place to support the health and well-being of all of your employees that prepare you for what happens if and when somebody does disclose a need for accommodation? Because let's say they do come to you and they say, hey, listen, like I'm in early recovery and I need to let you know that like I'm working too many hours. I can't go to meetings. what do you say? Do you say tough? Because that's legal, so you can't just say that. Yeah, you can't do that. You got to know. And that's, I think, when we used to do a lot of our trainings around the state, and even today when I do a lot of work with employers on non-traditional talent, one of the first things we cover is ADA, FMLA, OSHA. We go through the regulations that really do say, for the most part, like, you have to help these people. But also, we use that to build the foundation. Because if people, if HR representatives and supervisors understand that, like, oh, this isn't an option we have, this is something we have to do, then they're more likely to just go, okay, this is what's happening.
Right.
And I think that's the hardest part. We do have a circumstance, and I think with people in early recovery as well, where on the more social services side, we need to just get better about helping them connect to better jobs. That's not on employers, because as I said, if they can pass a drug test and they're an able-bodied individual who's qualified for the job, on the social services side, we need to do a better job, and our nonprofits need to do a better job just saying, hey, you know what, like, you're better than the grocery store. You're better than the gas station. You're better than you name it. You can have a career, because they really don't believe that they can. And if we tell them, hey, while you get yourself into recovery and while you start this journey, this is all you're able to do, this is all you're good enough for, I mean, how would that feel to hear that?
Well, it's pretty much where they're stuck if people keep telling them that, unfortunately.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there's a saying in recovery, like, nothing changes if nothing changes. Then I feel like at the same time, sometimes there's a narrative of you're not good enough yet for the change when it comes to this. And I think that's wrong.
And I think one thing that's important to remember, that this is also covered under the ADA.
Yeah.
You know, I think some employers may not think it is, but substance abuse is covered. So
yeah, so to be clear, you can't be hired drunk on a job site or at work ever. But if you're not engaging in illicit behavior or behavior that's directly against corporate policy, and you come and you request assistance, if I'm an individual who goes to my employer and says, hey, listen, like, I realized I'm drinking too much. I'm using drugs. I need to go get help today. There is an obligation to an extent, depending on your size and safety regulations, to accommodate that.
Right.
And on the other end, if you're a person who is in recovery, you know, like myself, and I go to my employer and I say, hey, listen, like, I'm struggling and I need to go to more meetings. I need to go meet with a counselor. I need to do X, Y, or Z to manage my chronic disease that I have. It gets treated the same way as if I had diabetes, as if I had any other, you know, chronic heart or health condition. And that's how it has to get treated. It's okay. Let's figure out what a reasonable accommodation can be to help you take care of yourself.
If you're an employer and one of your employees has a relapse, like, how would you, I know we talked about a second chance, but, you know, how would you recommend employers deal with those relapses?
So I think it's twofold. One is encourage voluntary disclosure and accommodation. So if an employee over the weekend has a relapse and they come in on Monday sober and go, I need to go to the hospital, I need more help. You help them every time. If they don't have a performance issue at work, they're doing their job well, and they, you know, have a little slip, make it a little slip. Treat them like that's what it is and give them all the support they can possibly need, so that way they can get back to work and be a good productive employee, but then also, like, get well. However, if it comes up instead through a disciplinary process where they're not doing their job, they're showing up late, they fail a drug test. Failing a drug test has to have its own type of consequence according to corporate policy. Generally, it looks like we were tracking when we were at the chamber a couple different best practice second chance policies, and really they were second chance policies. Places that would just funnel people in and out of treatment 8-10 times, it didn't seem to have any positive association with outcomes. But you failed your first drug test, go get help, and then come back with a written process being, hey, we're going to drug test you more now after this. You're going to have a probationary period, basically, where now that you failed this one drug test, you will get drug tested more. It's no longer random. It's, you will get drug tested more on this type of schedule. Still somewhat random, but, you know, on a more frequent schedule.
Right.
If you fail another one of those drug tests, that's it. But then I think the bigger thing, though, really is figuring out the process for, like, what happens when that slip occurs. Because there will be a slip way before there's a fall. And so if we can just even note, if you, let's say we are noticing, like, all right, Bob is showing up. All of a sudden, Bob starts behaving not like Bob, meaning not like Bob in recovery. Bob goes through treatment one time, gets better, comes back in, starts killing it, you know, doing great work. But all of a sudden, starts showing up a little bit late, missing deadlines, having some interpersonal issues. You know, maybe starts talking about money problems again, you know, whatever it may be. Behaviors that were like old Bob. Before even the failed drug test or discipline has to happen, can happen or should happen, I think there's another obligation to just have a conversation of, are you okay? And is there anything we can help you with? We've noticed these behaviors that we've listed out. Can we help you with anything? Let the person disclose what's going on and then help them. You know, help them get back on that right path. Because that's – we worked with Krieg DeVault throughout a lot of our education, and there are some amazing speakers there. And they would always just say it's always okay to ask if you're okay. You can go, hey, are you okay? Hey, do you need help? And if somebody says yes, start the process. Help them. Like, that's a fairly common attitude or thing to hopefully do. But sometimes it can feel intimidating. You don't want to probe into their life. But, like, if they're not doing their job, you can ask them if they're okay. And then if they just say, like, yeah, everything's fine, or they might tell you something completely different. They might go, oh, you know what, my dad died yesterday, you know, or hey, like, I get something completely else going on. Okay, let's help you with that too.
You know, I think employers obviously should be offering these types of programs too, right? I mean, they should, as part of their benefits package, that should be something that they should probably have as part of it.
I think so. I think a good second chance policy makes a lot of sense. And also just in general, and the pandemic has had a huge impact on this. The presence of standalone EAPs now versus embedded policies, you know, I guess I should spell it out a little bit. Embedded meaning it's a tag, it's a ride along on your health insurance or another policy that you really don't pay anything for, but you just get as a passive benefit. Those traditionally are not as in depth as one, a independent service that you're paying for on its own to be an EAP. Those standalone EAPs are way more common now than they've ever been. I rarely interact with employers who don't have one now. And I think that's the kind of thing that you just have to know, how are we actively, not just passively saying it exists during your orientation booklet, but how are we actively communicating it so people can feel like even confidentially that they can reach out to, you know, the EAP and go like, hey, I need to get therapy. Hey, I need to get help. How many free counseling sessions are included? And just look at that stuff.
And I know you guys are doing at Invest Hamilton County some really cool things around mental health and substance abuse. Can you talk just a little bit about, and I know you've kind of touched on some of those things, but.
So most of the things we're doing right now are very, well, so we launched a multi-year education programming period in partnership with the local chambers. And we did a bunch of mental health first aid education that we only charge businesses $5 to attend, mostly so that way they'd show up. Normally it costs around $500. So with very gracious funding from the commissioners and council, we were able to make that happen for a lot of local businesses. We also produced some evidence-based resource guides. We did some marijuana education. To be clear, marijuana in the workplace education for businesses. We didn't teach people how to use marijuana. The other thing we did was produce kind of a 101 level resource guide and helped kickstart some gap analysis questions within the community, which eventually led us. So Invest Hamilton County, the community, the Hamilton County Community Foundation, and then also the Hamilton County Commissioners and Council did end up standing up a new countywide behavioral health collaborative, which we're on the guiding team for, that really is now helping to drive bigger picture ecosystem-wide conversations on these topics. And that will make a huge difference in the long run in our community, just having everybody together rowing in the same direction, because there's a lot of money in that space right now. From a healthcare and mental health and support side, we need to make sure how that aligns with the rest of our, for example, justice system involvement, and also our just businesses and capacity. So,
I guess before we get into a less serious part of our conversation, is there anything else you'd like to share around this topic? And just to be clear, I mean, you've covered some really good and shared some really good information I think our employers will really get a lot out of.
I think I'm good so far. I think I hit most of the things that I'd probably look to dig into.
One thing we'd like to do before we wrap up these conversations is have like a rapid fire question section. All fun, nothing serious. Kind of the first thing that pops in your head. What do you wish you would have learned sooner? It doesn't have to be about this topic. It could be about anything.
I wish you would have learned sooner how to say no to things in a kind way.
I'm still learning that. Best career advice you've ever received?
The best career advice I ever received was probably just to put self-care at the center of everything, meaning for both me and my employees. So when I think of any new program that I'm going to take on, I think of any new priority that we're going to do, regardless of the amount of good it could do in the community, the amount of money it could bring into an organization, the amount of whatever, if in saying yes to that, the self-care of my own employees will suffer, as in their lives are going to become a lot harder and a lot worse, and therefore I probably wouldn't be able to maybe keep them or keep them as happy, it is something I at least have to think about saying no to.
Normally, I would ask what's your favorite fast food restaurant, but since we just talked about self-care, I won't go there. And we'll go to hobby.
I love golf. Yeah. I just finished a four-day trip in Northern Michigan with some buddies, like even just this last weekend. That's probably my main go-to.
I just actually just got back from a 90-hole golf tournament that started last Friday and ended on Sunday.
I literally did the same thing. We were probably playing golf simultaneously all three of those days. Yeah.
90 holes was rough.
It was a lot. My spiritual and physical self, even today, are still very misaligned. How my back feels versus how my soul feels. You know, I'm very filled up in one and very sore in the other. So,
yeah. I get that. It's been hard to get up the last few days. What quote resonates with you the most?
So honestly, one that I end up doing a lot, especially in this job, is I Fear is the Mind Killer from Dune by Frank Herbert. It's an amazing book that actually recently, I guess, became a movie too. Well, it's became another movie. It's been a bunch of movies. But I talk about that a lot because I say fear is the job killer. I say it's the recovery killer. I mean, fear, I talk about fear a lot in my job. So that's probably one for now that comes to mind.
What's your favorite movie?
Probably Star Wars Empire Strikes Back.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
All right, I'll let you off the hook with some of these others, but I'd like to thank you for joining us today. It's been very good information that you've shared. This has been one of the better podcasts that I've been able to participate in, so thanks again, and thank you all for listening.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for tuning in for another episode of the DE Talk podcast. Stay connected with direct employers on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn, and subscribe to our emails by visiting directemployers.org/subscribe to receive notifications of new episodes, webinars, events, and more.